All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our Tuesday night Parsha class / 12-step. This week's Torah portion is the portion of Vayera. If you want to open up the Chumash, we can go to page 94. For the web audience, we're going to the beginning of chapter 18. It's interesting how from the beginning of the creation till the first Jew, the Torah records 19 generations.
Up until now.
All of which are recorded in two Torah portions or less. And the life of the first Jew of Abraham takes up three portions in the Torah. Last week, this week, and next week. So we are in the middle of a story, and there's something very powerful in the first verse, in the first pasuk of this week's portion, which is very much connected to the idea, and deeply connected to the idea of the fifth step. Just a big background on the Parsha. Avram Avinu is already 99 years old. His wife Sarah is 90. God comes to him. And that was last week. And God notifies him that he's going to have a son with his wife, which was nothing less than miraculous. But for him to merit that miracle, God gave him the commandment of the Bris Milah, of the Brit Milah. And this week's Torah portion opens up about what happened immediately after he fulfilled that commandment. So Avram Avinu fulfilling the mitzvah of circumcision, not only for himself, but for his entire family, and for all of those whom in those days there was slavery, to the people whom he owned, all did a Bris Milah, and the portion opens up that God appeared to him, and the Torah says where that meeting took place. God appeared to him in a place called Eloine Mamre, in the plains that belonged to a man called Mamre, while Avram Avinu was sitting at the door of his tent, etc., etc. And the question that everyone has is that why was it important for the Torah to record the location where God appeared to Abraham? So what that he was in the plains of Mamre? Says Rashi that Mamre was one of Abraham's friends. And just quoting the words of Rashi superficially, when God commanded Abraham to do something, which was to do the circumcision, right, it was very clear to him the right and the wrong. The right was to do what God wants, to make the bris, and the wrong would be, God forbid, not to listen. So Avraham, he was looking for advice. By his friends, he went to talk it through with his friends. He went to Mamre to ask him for an etza. And Mamre, his friend, told him, "Well, if God told you to do it, then do it." So he did it. So God wants to give credit to Mamre for him giving good advice to Abraham. And the honor that God gives Mamre, the reward is that he's recorded in this verse. That where did God appear to Abraham? In the territory that belonged to Mamre. And the question is obvious. Why did he seek counsel? God told him what to do. And if Mamre, his friend, would have told him not, then he wouldn't have listened to God? So let's hold the question. That's everyone's question. Okay, in the 12 steps, we're going to go on to the fifth step. For those who are new to this, all right, so there's a series of steps. That the truth is that any person who is seeking to become more spiritual will gain tremendous benefits by going through. And people who have certain addictions will get healed by it. So the step that we're going to focus on tonight, and God willing, perhaps next week, is the following, is the need to admit to God and to oneself and to another human being or other human beings the exact nature of our wrongs. In other words, after step four, after a person made a real searching, after we are looking for, to the best of our ability, to the root of certain behaviors that are not good. And again, we're not looking to define the behavior. We know the behavior, but we're trying to the best of our ability to understand where this is coming from. And we acknowledge that any behavior that's not good is coming really from a certain internal part of us that is not good. And we do the best of our ability to make a searching and to find that wrong. That's step four. So after we do step four, it's important now to admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another person or to other people. Many people wrongfully think that step five sounds like the minhag of the Catholics to make confession. Not that. We're not talking about confessing. When we are trying to make an introspection, the biggest challenge that every human being will have is that because of self-love, which is a natural, healthy human trait, we will have a great challenge to have clarity, to see clearly that which is not good inside of me. Even when we look at other people and we think we're objective, there too we have to be very wise to be able to have an insight, to see what is the right and what is the wrong, what is the good and what needs to become good. Thousandfold is when we look into ourselves. Now let me give you a couple of stories just to illustrate that. And this is a universal law. This goes to all people. This goes even to great tzaddikim. Today, before it got dark, today, the 11th day of Mar Cheshvan, happens to be the day of passing the yahrzeit of one of the great tzaddikim, which was the first Rebbe of Chernobyl. His name was Rav Nachum Chernobyl. Alright, he was a student both of the Baal Shem Tov, and he was later a student of the Magid of Mezrich. He was a colleague, a lot older, but nevertheless a colleague of the first Rebbe of Chabad. We have a tradition that he was very obese, and the man didn't eat. And they asked him, how did he put on the pounds? So he says that the pleasure that he gets when he used to go to the synagogue and when he used to say Amen or Amen Yehei Shmei Rabba, he got so much pleasure that from that he became fat. Just give you an idea of what type of person we're talking about. Right, his day of passing many years ago was today, the 11th day. Today is also the passing of Rachel while she gave birth to Binyamin. Today, the 11th of the month of Cheshvan. So here's his story. He, for some divine reason, was extremely poor. Now understand something, he was a very, very great Rebbe. Thousands of people, literally thousands of people, went to him to seek counsel. And it was the custom then that great Rebbes, unlike today, you know, in modern America, you have, let's say, a psychologist or you have a counselor that have a fee. A Rebbe doesn't have a fee, but people, after they would speak to him, would leave. He used to have on the table a plate, and whoever can afford gave more, whoever couldn't afford gave less, but people used to leave something. Most great Rebbes were not extremely poor. They survived. For some reason, he was terribly poor. And the person who used to bear the biggest burden of the poverty wasn't him, but it was his manager, if you can say that. In Yiddish, it's called the gabbai. So when his household needed to go to the market to buy food, the Rebbe didn't go. The gabbai went. And when the Rebbe didn't pay because there was no money, so then the storekeeper didn't harass the Rebbe. He harassed the gabbai. So the gabbai was under tremendous financial pressure. One day, while he was receiving many people, a certain gentleman who the gabbai did not know notified the gabbai, "I want you to know that I'm going to see the Rebbe here, and because of him, that and the other great things happened to me, and I financially made it. And just for you to know that I'm going to leave for him 300 ruble," which was a tremendous amount of money in those days. When the gabbai heard this, he couldn't, you know, there was a big people who, God forbid, are under tremendous financial stress. The stress was the gabbais. You hear you're getting a lot of money, it's you feel a relief, you know. And he already began to calculate who he's going to pay, how much. That wouldn't resolve the whole debt, but he already went through his mind. He was so excited, he's going to pay this to that one and this to the other one, and they're going to leave him alone for a while. At the end of the day, when people finally left, no more people, he runs into the room and he looks at the plate and he sees a couple of little copper coins there. There was nothing at the table, a couple of dollars. So he says, Rebbe, there was a yid that I know, just one guy said he's leaving 300 ruble. So the Rebbe says, wow, look, a miracle happened. He says, right after this guy left, and he left the 300 ruble, another man came in to me, and he was a very wealthy person, and unbeknownst to anyone, he lost all his wealth. And until that, it's very humiliating, and it was very challenging, and he was about to marry off a child, and he was afraid, that Jew, that if he would let everyone know that he went bankrupt, that his child's shidduch can get broken up. So he was trying to keep, you know, he was wealthy, he was still acting as if he was wealthy, and they were going to make a big wedding, and he needed 300 ruble. That's what he's telling the Rebbe. No, he told that to the Rebbe. So the Rebbe told his Gabbai, I want you to know, that the moment that Jew told it, that was the guy. So one guy left him 300, and the next guy came in to ask him that he needs 300 ruble. So the Rebbe says, the first thing that came into my head is from God. There's 300 ruble, that's for the guy who needs it. But then I began to think to myself, is it right to give so much money just to help one person? 300 ruble today would be like $100,000. He says, maybe I should divide it into 10, and I can really help 10 Jews.
Look out for yourself.
Himself he never thought about. So he had this dilemma. So here you have a tzaddik, right? We're not talking about choosing between right and wrong. Between right, he didn't know what's right. So he says, what did I do? He says, I closed my eyes and I made a real introspection, and I concluded like this. This is only for a tzaddik. That the first thought that came into my head, that was from God. The first thought that came into his head was to help that guy with giving him the whole money. Every time we're about to do something good, there's always that negative force that comes and challenges us. So the second thought came from my negative side. So I gave the guy the whole 300 ruble. This is what he told the Gabbai, just to explain what happened to the 300 ruble. What I want to bring out from that story is that even the greatest of tzaddikim, they don't know themselves if a certain idea that they have is coming from their good side or coming from their bad side. So if a tzaddik like him struggles to figure himself out, imagine people like us. As much as we can make a searching, and as much as we can, to the best of our ability, with all of our honesty, come to certain conclusions, we'll never be on the button. We'll always be off. Not off for the good or for the bad. Exaggerating either direction is not healthy. It means we have to know our defaults, and we have to know our strengths, and we have to know them equally. If not, we don't know who we are. We don't know where to begin. We might know where we need to get, but we have to know where we are, and then when you know where you are and you know where you need to get, then you have work to do. So I can know where I would like to be, but I have to know where I am. It's very challenging. And even talking about it to God doesn't help to get clarity. There is nothing better than speaking to another human being or to other human beings. The feedback that we get when we share, and it's very challenging, it's very humbling, we become vulnerable, and rightfully so, and therefore we have to be careful that if we are a person who's going to share his or her inner makings, and I'm making my inventory and I'm trying to figure myself out and I want to share with people, not my behavior, which everyone knows already, but I'm trying to share where I'm really at, the good in me, according to my understanding, the bad in me, according to my understanding, I have to share it with people whom I can trust. There's no debate about that. But I have to try to find those people. And I have to find those people. And I have to share. And I have to make myself vulnerable. And I have to admit to other people, not confessing in the sense that if I'm going to confess my sins, I'm going to be forgiven. No. Pasha, to get clarity. when I tell you what I think about myself, and if you're my friend, the feedback that you'll give me is unbelievable. Never underestimate it. So the first benefit of sharing is that we'll get clarity about the inventory that we made. And sometimes I can share and people won't give me feedback the first time. Sometimes it can take you two times or three times. But the idea of people getting together and really opening up and telling each other, you know, this is what I'm feeling. What do you think? We're going to come back to Abraham soon. That is a necessary exercise. It's very humbling. And therefore, the part of us that has ego, the negative part of us, fights against it. Many people don't do it because it's going to deflate their ego. If I'm going to really open up who I am, then okay, true. There's some good in me and there's some not good in me, and you're going to know about that. And it's very humbling. Which is another indication that it's a great thing to do. It's just it's hard to do it. Many groups have different names for that. Hasidim, Chabad Hasidim, call this a Fabrengen. This was instituted from the beginning of the foundation of Hasidus, that people get together, men get together with men, women get together with women. These are the real old-time Fabrengen. And the goal of getting together were people, they would open themselves up, they would speak about themselves, and they would get feedback. And there was no mercy in the Fabrengen. In the good old Fabrengen, people, and it was, you know, when you're in a safe setting, that's exactly what we want. It's the best therapy. It's amachaya. First, they get clarity. And in that setting, people have the liberty to tell you what they really think about you. You know, you're arrogant, and they don't tell you your beauty. They tell you how ugly you are. And when a person is understands that he's going to go through that, it's very well received and it's very healthy. It clarifies many, many things. I never would have known if I wouldn't have done it. Yes. Process group. Okay, but yeah, it's unbelievable. Now, it's interesting that I can tell you for myself, I'm 43. When I was younger, and it was a certain change, these types of gatherings amongst Chabad Hasidim was more common. There were times that people broke me down until the dust of the earth, and it was very healthy. They started with my glasses. I don't know, they pick on you. They did it from love. And they would go into you and they would really point out to the person, if I was the victim, not the victim, I was in Baruch Hashem, I was the recipient of a medicine, it was medication. And they really gave it to you. They really told it to you the way it is. And it was very humbling. Sometimes they banged you on your head until you push it, would break down and cry. But you knew that the guy who was doing it really loves you. If it's done in a healthy setting, it's great. And over the time, I see less and less of it, which is sad. And part of that is that because it's very challenging, you know, it's humbling. So that's one. So just the concept of a sponsor, at least having one person whom you can talk to, is very important, certainly in the long run. Again, not that we're stupid, and we do have when we make an inventory, we could get a very good idea of who we are. But once we really go deep, we'll be off. We need someone else to help us. That's one reason why we need step number five, why we have to admit to others our wrongs. Not for them to forgive us, just for me to get clarity. There's another very deep shift that's going to happen inside of me if I can fight my ego and I can open up, again, in a safe environment, either to a person or to people, and share my wrongs. And that is that deep down, many people are very isolated. It's funny, even people who seem to be very social, people who seem to, you know, to have a community and they make a good conversation and they have a lot of friends, deep down, many people are very alone. And when a person has the ability in the right setting to share their good and their bad, a very deep feeling of isolation is not only alleviated, not only that goes away, but the opposite comes into its place. A very deep bonding between people, which we all deeply need, takes place. I want to tell you a story. I said it here on Yom Kippur. First of all, the story is printed in a book. It's called, it was just printed recently. There's a book that was printed called Small Miracles from the Holocaust. It was printed last year. And I was thinking the story on itself is a beautiful story about, you know, people that were separated getting together. And every time people hear these stories, it's very moving because we all yearn for that. And I think that there's a lot of, I mean, this is a true story, but by divine providence, there's a lot more to the story than the story itself. And here's the story. Story is that in 1943, unfortunately, at the end of the war, the Second World War, the Nazis invaded Hungary. And for those who come from Hungary, the Jews of Hungary, in the beginning of the war, relative to the Jews of Eastern Europe, relative to the Polish Eden, they had it relatively good. But oy, did the Nazis take revenge. And in a very short amount of time, when they invaded Hungary, they shipped off Jews straight to Auschwitz, quick. They wanted to kill as many Jews as they could. So the story goes that when the Hungarian Jews were arriving in Auschwitz, Auschwitz is in Poland, so there were two Polish sisters, not Jews, two Polish sisters that were working in the camp, and their job was to go through the articles that the Jews who were sent by Mengele to get burned, to get murdered, so they would separate the articles. You know, the Hungarian Jews came with a lot of things. And these two sisters were not that honest. And whenever they had an opportunity to take something for themselves, not judging them, just, you know, for survival or for whatever, they were. And they, you know, once you go down that path, they got good at it. So when people came off and they knew that those people are going to get killed, so they right away, they made sure to go after the ones who were wearing the fancier coats and the better, wealthier people. More things will be found there and more opportunity to take. And these two women, they saw how a Jewish woman was wearing a very, very expensive fur coat. Very thick fox fur coat, the way they describe it. And they said, hey, we're getting that coat. And they waited and waited until finally her time came. She had to give up her coat. And they saw when she took off her coat that she took it off with tremendous anguish. More than usual. So at first they thought, you know, she's very materialistic. It was hard to say goodbye to the coat. Little, you know, what did she know? She's saying goodbye to her life. And they found an opportunity out to go into a place where no one was watching them, and they started going through her coat. And they saw the gold coat had a lot more than the fur coat. There was gold in there, and there was jewelry in there, and there was, and they feel something wiggling in there. And they find in the coat, wrapped up, a infant, a few days old, was in the coat. And they understood now this woman didn't want to take off her coat because of that. Now, one of these two Polish women was a woman who was in her 40s. She did not have children. She was very heavy set. And she tells her sister, we both know what's going to happen to this baby if we tell the Nazis that there's a Jewish baby here. She says, I don't have children. She says, this is my opportunity. And they made a plan. First of all, there was a lot of gold in there. There was a lot of valuables in that coat. And that woman felt that she can live off that for a long time. So she somehow managed to pocket that. And the plan was that her sister cut her, so there was a lot of blood. And she told the guards there that she was pregnant, and, you know, she was heavy set, and she went into labor early. And this was her baby. And they believed her. She got away with it. And they let her leave the camp with her baby, and her sister was helping her. And she never went back. She came home to her husband. She told her husband that we got a baby. She was happy. Her husband was happy. They had money. They decided right then that they have to leave Poland. They went back to Budapest. They went to Hungary. And amongst the articles that they took from that coat was a very exquisite, a very beautiful golden pendant, a chain, with a locket. And they opened the locket and they had in there Hebrew letters. They never told this baby that she was adopted. They raised that baby as their own. And they were good parents, and they gave her a great education. Long story short, she turned out to be a pediatric surgeon, this young woman. And at a certain point in her life, both of her parents, or whom she thought were her parents, were in a car accident, and they both got killed. And during the riot, a few days after her parents got killed, her aunt comes over to her with a letter. And she tells her, I apologize for all of the pain that you're going to go through by reading this letter, but I took an oath to your sister that after she won't be here, I'm going to give you this letter. And her mom, right, wrote in the letter, if you're reading the letter, that means I'm no longer here, and she's writing now to this woman the real story, that you're not my daughter. She says that she described how she found her, and the truth is that she saved her life, but she wanted her to know that she's Jewish. And this woman went out of her mind. No, you can only imagine. You know, all of a sudden, you don't know who you are. And her aunt is trying to calm her down. She says, nothing changed. What changed? It's amazing how a little piece of information can change everything. And nothing changes. But everything changes. I have to know who I am. What else did you guys find with me? And then they remembered that there was this pendant that had some Hebrew letters. So she made her aunt go and find it. And her aunt went to her deceased adopted mother's home, and she went looking through her stuff, and they found the pendant. And she goes ahead, and she calls a rabbi in Budapest. And she tells the rabbi her story, and she shows the pendant. She says, what does it say in the pendant? So the rabbi says, at least from here you know your name. And it said, Leah Bas Miriam. So now she knows her name. Is there a family name here? There was no family name, but at least she knows her Hebrew name. She told the rabbi, what should she do? Imagine, a person finds out that they're Jewish. A pediatric surgeon in Budapest. So that rabbi told this woman that... He gave her good advice. He says, listen, your scenario is very unique, and I'm definitely not qualified to give you direction. But at that time, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was alive. Write him a letter. And she wrote him a letter. She wrote him her story, and she was asking him, what should she do? She just found out that she's Jewish. She says, a few weeks later, someone knocks at her door. That's a beautiful story. The Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't respond to her with a letter. He felt that this should be addressed in person. So the Rebbe sent a couple to speak to them. The Shluchim in Budapest were sent to talk to them. And they said that we have a response from the Rebbe, but the Rebbe wanted us to convey it to you in person. And what the Rebbe basically was telling her was that it's highly advisable for her to discover her roots. If she's Jewish, discover what that is. The Rebbe encouraged her to move to Israel. The Rebbe told her that Israel is in need of pediatric surgeons. And the Rebbe told her that if he's making that suggestion, and he'll back it up with the whole with the Chabad organization, that if she's going to choose to go to Israel, the Rebbe says he's going to help her to move there. He's going to help her. You know, when you're a doctor in one country, it doesn't mean that another country is going to recognize that diploma. And it's sometimes very challenging for professional people who move places. You know, in one place, you're the big doctor. Over there, you're starting from scratch. The Rebbe told her he's going to help her be able to practice medicine in Israel. And she did that. And she managed. She moved to Israel. She discovered her roots. She became observant. She got married. She had kids. And the story doesn't end over there. So the story goes that in 2001, for those of us who remember, she decided to go with her family to a place in Yerushalayim called the Ben Yehuda Outdoor Mall, to a pizzeria called the Sabaro Pizza Shop. If you guys remember. All right. So she goes to the pizza shop, and thank God, right before she gets there, that's when the terrible thing had that the terrorist exploded, detonated himself. It was a suicide bomber, and it was a disaster. Many people were injured right there. And the ambulances started coming in. She noticed that her children are fine. She's a doctor. She jumped on the first ambulance with the child. She was a pediatric surgeon, and that's what they needed. And she's working, she's helping the kids to the best of her ability, and she describes that the ER in Yerushalayim was hell. You can imagine, children maimed, hurt, and she's trying to, you know, amongst the other doctors, doing the best that they could, and amongst the commotion, there's an old man shouting, where is my granddaughter? And he was an older person that was very stubborn, and you know, in those situations, you need calm. Commotions don't help. And he was making a gewalt, where's my granddaughter? Finally, he located his granddaughter, and he's shouting next to, calmly, he's shouting for the doctors to help her. Now, his granddaughter was not injured that badly. So the doctors, you know, priority, you got to save lives first. So they were going to leave her for Leah. He's making a scandal over there. So this Leah decides she'll deal with him. She walks over to him. She tries to calm him down. She asks him nicely to leave. He's not leaving. He's staying right there in the chaos. Okay? So she begins telling him that every moment is precious, that let's deal with the people that have worse injuries, and he's not his granddaughter. So she decided under that circumstance, the best thing is to deal with the granddaughter quickly to get them both out, just to calm things down. So she began, she saw the wounds of this young girl was not serious, but she began to undress her, to address the wounds. And as she's undressing her, she sees, right, the doctor sees on this little girl the same pendant she's wearing, Bidiyuk, that golden pendant, it looks just like hers. And she never saw that before, it was a handmade. So she freezes, she tells the old man, he says, where did you buy this? So the man says, yes, you can't buy, he says. He says, before the war, he says, I was a jeweler. He says, I made two pendants like this. He says, I had two daughters. Wow. He says, one is the mom of this girl that's injured. And says, the other one I gave to my baby that was killed right in the beginning of the war. So the surgeon asks this old man, I have two questions for you. He says, was your wife's name Miriam? He says, was your daughter, the infant daughter, was her name Leah? That was her dad. Can you imagine? That she met in that crazy disaster of a moment in a hospital in Yerushalayim. Now, these stories, first of all, they're very moving. And there's a reason why they're very moving. Because deep down inside of us, we all yearn to connect. On a very deep level, most people are very isolated. Because most people don't practice the fifth step. Most people don't have the courage and the humility that's needed to share, to really share. Not to show off, not to project the beauty. No. To share the good and the bad. And to seek counsel and to tell people, Herzachayim, what do you think? I think that and the other, not my behavior. Everyone knows what my behavior is. No. The real root that's underneath the behavior, go share that with someone else. Very vulnerable, very challenging. When people do that, you bond. And when people don't do that, by the way, the isolation that people feel deep down is terrible. We might not be aware of it, but it's terrible. We were not meant to be isolated. When God created Adam and Chava connected together. And there was a reason for that, because people need to be connected. And if we don't find it in our lives, then when we hear a story about people connecting, it makes us cry. We're not crying for them, we're crying for ourselves. Because we're all looking for that. That's the fifth step. There's another advantage. There's another power of admitting to others, sharing with others that which is really going inside of us. So we have clarity and we have bonding. We get rid of being isolated, being alone, loneliness. There's another issue. There's a verse in the Torah that says, Da'ago belev ish. Really it says, Yashcheno, but the Talmud says, read it, Yisicheno, which means that if a man or woman has a worry in their hearts, they should speak it out. Which is, by the way, the root of all modern-day therapy. Why is it important to speak it out? Amongst many things, this is the way the Talmud puts it. An amazing idea. You should know like this, that emotions, and we spoke about it a few times already, that there's this order, the deeper part of us, the more external part of us, or the higher and the lower. So if the lower is the lowest is what we do, the behavior level, right? And then we have the words that we speak and our consciousness, and then we have our emotions, and higher than that is the way we understand things. So in Kabbalah, understanding is higher than emotions. Nevertheless, there is something that emotions have that are much greater than intellect. And that is, emotions are non-limited. They're limitless. And intellect, by definition, is limited. Which means like this. When we have an emotion, when we feel something, before we put it into words, those emotions are huge, which is why many people get emotionally overwhelmed. Overwhelming means that there is a feeling that I'm experiencing that is bigger than me. It's bigger than me. It's swallowing me up. For the good or for the bad. There are certain emotions that people cannot contain. And there's a magic. The moment you begin verbalizing it, you contain it. Because what is a word? A word is a container. A word is a box, right? You're taking a feeling and you're describing it. So you're giving it a beginning and you're giving it an end. So if a person, God forbid, has a very negative emotion, just by talking about it, that negativity became contained. A person is experiencing pain. Why do we shout, oi? Why do we give word to it? Because it helps. Well, it doesn't take away the pain. It takes the edges off the pain. And by the way, when the pain is so great, there are times that we can't even put it into words. So when people say, I don't know what to say, they really don't know what to say. You know, there is an emotion that is so great that it doesn't fit into words, and people don't say. There are even emotions that don't fit into sound in Kabbalah. Person is like, wow. And then after a while, the first sound you can make is you can shout. That's the shofar. And then after a while, then you're able to put it into words. But once you are able to put any feeling into words, you limit it. So here, not only am I getting clarity, not only am I addressing a very deep need that all of us have, is to be connected to others, but I'm already now beginning to resolve my problem. By admitting my problem, I'm resolving my problem, because when I put my problem into words, especially when it's going to be corrected by the other, but now I'm already limiting it. So whatever it is that is wrong within me, the very fact that it fits into words makes it not that bad. It's not that great. You can word it. You can express it. And we all have that experience. Both in the good and in the negative, what seems the not good. That the moment you verbalize it, it became smaller. There's another advantage of the step. And this is even deeper. And this is, I'll tell you a statement that one of the Chabad Rebbe said when he was encouraging Hasidim getting together and having a real Fabrengen. And what was the word? I'm sorry, what was that term that you used? Group processing. It's for people to get together and to really open up and to share, you know, to seek counsel from the fellow man. Listen, I see myself like that. Is that correct or not? And what do you think I need to do to better myself? Just to talk it through. Not because the other person is smarter than me. Just because he's not me. He has a better picture. He sees me better than me. So the Rebbe said like this, that when two people get together and their goal is to try to better one of theirs negative traits. So me and you are talking about that negative part of me. So the Rebbe used those words. The fifth Chabad Rebbe, when two people get together, you have two godly souls against one animal soul. Two against one, normally the two win. Especially if the two are godly and one is animal, then for sure the godly will win. So when me and you are having a discussion about something negative in me, so he says, so what happens is that we have two godly souls ganging up against one animal soul. That was what he said, and everyone asks, that doesn't make sense. One second. If every person has a godly soul and an animal soul, so when two people get together, how many godly souls do you have? Two. But how many animal souls do you have? Two. It's two and two. Why is it that if me and you get together, all of a sudden the two godly souls, that, yeah, but why is there only one animal soul? What's the answer to that? But if your godly soul is trying to help my godly soul, wouldn't your animal soul try to help my animal soul? No. Bidiyuk. Exactly. The animal soul only has an ego. It's me. It's not about you. And even if it connects externally, it's external. It's not deep. There's no deep, deep connection. And when we're getting together to speak deep, we're not coming together to speak about, listen, this is what I did. Let me tell you what I did. No one wants to know what I did. They saw what I did. It's not going to help anything. But let me share with you an insight to tell you what I think about myself. Why is it that I did what I did? This is what I think was behind it. And it's never going to be something pretty if that which I did wasn't pretty. So the emotion behind it, the idea behind it, whatever the root of it is not pretty. When I share that, and the other person is either going to make it bigger, make it smaller, tell me I'm totally off, or I got it exactly, I'm just going to get a good confirmation. I'm looking in the mirror, I'm getting clarity. While that process is happening, if that person is indeed my friend, a part of me wants to help me, and the godly part of you wants to help me too. So there's more power here being focused and directed towards my help. Your animal soul couldn't care about me. It's not going to help my animal soul. It's not going to knock my animal soul. It doesn't care about it. It doesn't exist. Just you exist. So when two people get together, make no mistake, the holy in us, the godly in us, that unites. The ego, the animal soul, every man for himself. Now let's go back to Abraham. We started off with a question, a classical question. God commanded Abraham, you do a mitzvah. Abraham went to seek counsel by Mamre. What was that all about? So, like, you have the classical answers is that he didn't ask Mamre if he should do that. God forbid. God told him to do it. God said to do it. He's going to do it. What he spoke to Mamre was like this, that God didn't only command him to circumcise himself. God commanded him to circumcise himself, and he had a son, Yishmael, who was 13, and there were other household members whom Abraham was commanded to circumcise. Trying to circumcise an adult, not that simple. No one should try it on me. All right, it's amazing. But parenthetically, when you just read about all of these Jews that left this, you know, the ex-Soviet Union, and over there, it was illegal to practice religion under the penalty of sometimes death. And you have thousands and thousands of Jews with no Jewish education that came to the United States or to Russia. This is amazing. All ages. And they were looking to find someone who's going to circumcise them. Unbelievable. Here you see the holy in the person. That if I'm a Jew and that's my mitzvah, so the holy in me really wants to do that. And it's so crazy. That's another whole story. It's beautiful. Sometimes you really see the soul, the neshama of another person. No education, nothing. They know it. I'm a Jew. A Jew has to be circumcised. I need to be circumcised. They know it's going to be painful. Anyways, you have these. So Avraham Avinu has to go and circumcise his household members. So his counsel, that's the classical answer. He was seeking counsel to get advice, how to verbalize it to them in a way that there'll be less opposition. In Kabbalah, we don't give that interpretation. They give a whole different interpretation. That's very deep. And this is what it says. Now you got to fast forward a little bit. In the Chumash itself, for those of us who are familiar with it, if you guys remember that Yaakov, the third of our fathers, had 12 sons that are recorded in the Chumash, correct? The 12 tribes. And the Torah records that he had a daughter. What was her name? By the way, why was she called Dina? What does Dina mean? Din means a judgment. What was the judgment? It's just fascinating. So I'll tell you what the Gemara says. Fascinating. And this is very relevant today. By the way, when you read stuff in the Talmud and it doesn't make sense to you, one day it will make sense to you. This is what happened. He was married to Leah. Leah had 6 sons up until that point. He was married to Leah's maidservant and to Rachel's maidservant. Each one already had 2 sons with him. So he had, by that point, how many sons did he have? 6 and 2, and he had 10 sons. They all knew that there's going to be 12. Rachel, we'll read later, was barren. She didn't have children yet. The max of sons that she could have had would have been 2, which means she would have had at least the same number of the other. Not as much as Leah, but at least as many children as the other wives. Leah gets pregnant. Talmud says she got pregnant with a boy. Rachel got pregnant with a girl. Leah judged herself And she says that, you know, if I'm going to have the boy, that means I'm going to have seven boys, so seven and two and two is 11, then the most of sons that Rachel will be able to have as one. That means she won't even have as much as the other wives. She felt that's not fair. So she prayed to God, and God sent an angel, and the angel took the embryo out of the womb of Leah and put it into Rachel, took the embryo of Rachel, put it into Leah, and Rachel gave birth to Joseph, and Leah gave birth to Dinah. This Talmud is the source, just parenthetically, this is a very modern halachic issue, an interesting issue, surrogate motherhood. It's happening today a lot, right? So if you have, you know, if the baby is Jewish or not Jewish, if the, right, the biological, right, the DNA came from the father and the mother, but it was planted in another woman, who's the mom? I know it's a legal issue as well, but this is the source in Jewish law to resolve this comes from the story that I just told you. And who was Joseph's mother? Rachel? Clear? He was Rachel's son. The obligation to honor his mother was to Rachel. When Rachel passed away, he mourned for her. The Torah says Dinah is Bas Leah. Dinah was the daughter of Leah, not Bas Rachel. So here you see that the mom is the one who carried. Anyways, the story with Leah was that unfortunately to Dinah, the Torah says she got captured by a man, right, Shechem. Remember that story? Hamor. And she was raped. And her brothers felt that being that raping a woman is against the Noahide laws, and they also knew, which is a very important rule in life, that when you witness something, non-acting is also acting. So being silent, the city people, the citizens who knew what was happening and did not at least protest against it, certainly did not attempt to stop that from happening, were guilty by Jewish law. And that's a very important rule in life. Sometimes people, you know, they don't want to mix in. Some scenarios you need to make, you have a responsibility. If you're witnessing something bad happening and you don't take a position, then you're consenting to it. And you're going to be accountable for that. So they were all accountable. And the decision was that they're going to be killed for that, which is the law before the Torah was given for a man raping a woman. That's a capital punishment. And those who could have prevented it from happening and did not are equally guilty, capital punishment. So you had a few brothers, ended up being two brothers, who decided they're gonna do justice. And how are they going to do justice? They were going to kill all of the inhabitants of that city. And that's a bit of a challenge. Two people against the whole city. So the Torah describes that what they did was they told the rapist and the other city people that really, if you want to marry our sister, fine, circumcise yourselves. The Torah records that story. And what happened on the third day of their circumcision? So they were weak. So that was the day that Shimon and Levi went into the city and they did what they felt was the right law, which is to kill the rapist before the Torah was given. After the Torah was given, there are other laws. But you kill a rapist before the Torah was given, and you kill all the people who could have prevented it from happening. Huh? They weren't punished for that. Jacob did not bless them. But anyway, let's leave that when we get to later. Okay, so now we know that when people are circumcised, it's common sense, but it's a biblical story, they're weak. And they're vulnerable for attack, physically. Last week, before Abraham circumcised himself, you guys remember the story that there were four kings and there were five kings, and the four kings and the five kings had a war, and then his nephew was kidnapped. Remember that story? Lot was kidnapped, and Avraham Avinu, with either Eliezer or he took a couple of 100 people, he went into war. He just went into battle. And he won a big battle. But there were people that were not happy with him. Now, as long as he's healthy and strong, he can protect himself. He's about to circumcise himself. So the Shulah HaKadosh is already Kabbalah says that what did he tell Mamre? He didn't ask him advice. God told him to do a mitzvah, he's doing the mitzvah. But he was afraid that the people whom he waged war in the past, who might have an axe to grind with him, might go and want to get back at him. And now that he's going to be circumcised, he's going to be weak. So he asked his friend Mamre, will you protect me? He went to talk it through to him by telling him that I'm becoming vulnerable. This is the Shlah. My enemies might attack me. Please help me. And Mamre says, I'll back you up. I have you back. You can do, you do what you need to do, and if anyone comes to attack you, I'm going to protect you. This is what the Shulah HaKadosh says. Now think about those words, and it's a lot deeper than what it sounds. Because whenever we speak about enemies, and yeah, there are external enemies, everything begins with us. Ultimately, I am my own enemy. And ultimately, when I know how to deal with my enemy inside of me, so then the external enemies will just vanish. They're only there to help me find my own enemy. So we can maybe, I understand that the Shulah HaKadosh is really saying like this, that when you're going to do a mitzvah, even a guy like Avraham Avinu, who's the enemy? The negative in us wants to attack us. It's trying to find how we are vulnerable. We're about to do a mitzvah. We're about to do the right thing. We can be a big tzaddik. Never be sure of yourself. And how did he guarantee that he's going to go ahead and do it? What was the protection against an enemy? Mamre. I'm not knocking Mamre. Mamre was no Abraham. He was another person. Another person gives you so much more power. You don't need for your friend to be a bigger tzaddik than yourself. So Abraham wasn't looking for, I don't know, his great-grandfather Shame, right, who would have been a big tzaddik. No. He had a neighbor, a nice neighbor. They shared. He shared his fears with Mamre. Mamre says, okay, now that you shared it with me, just the fact that he shared whatever it is that he felt, I'm vulnerable, I have a fear, he spoke it out to Mamre, that was his protection. That's the way I understand. So the concept of admitting something isn't only going to give us clarity and isn't only going to help us bond, and that's very deeply important for everyone, isn't only going to a certain degree, It's going to limit the negativity. It's going to box in the negativity, but it's already going to begin to help us overcome it. Even before we start to work on that, even before the next steps, simply by sharing. That's how powerful sharing is. And the biggest proof that it's powerful, the best proof of all, is that people always have a hard time doing it. Most of us need to witness someone else doing it. And usually we can only go as far as they went. Because most of us don't have the courage and don't have the humility. That's one of our faults. But the few ones of us that are lucky, that are amongst others, who saw this through others, who were inspired by others, a ripple effect, now it's our turn, now it's our responsibility to understand something, that when we have the courage in the right setting, to go ahead and not only to make an inventory, but to share with someone else the way we see, I'm admitting to someone else, this is the way I see myself. The good and the ugly, not only is it good for me, medicine for me, it's going to save me, it's going to inspire other people to do the same. And watch, one guy opens up, someone else opens up, so the third quiet person, maybe not the first time, but the stage was set. Sooner or later, if that's the way things work, other people are going to do it as well. So God should give us the courage, and this is courage. Courage and humility to go through with the fifth step, to learn. Just to finish off, you go back. When God created man, you know what God said? Who remembers the words in Hebrew? God says, let us make man. Let us make man. There's only one God. Who's the us? So Rashi says, God, he sought counsel. He talked it over with the angels. To teach the human being, you have something, you're about to do something, talk about it to the right person. Obviously, to someone who might be jealous, might be envious, not the right person. But to your friend, speak it over. Even if your friend is not as smart as you, right? No one is smarter, no one comes close to God. God spoke and he asked advice. What do you think? He was going to do it anyway, but he was showing us how to behave. There's nothing more powerful than admitting, than sharing, opening up, deeply opening up, not behavioral issues, deep issues, And when we do that, not only are we helping ourselves, but more importantly sometimes, we're helping many people that we know and many more people that we don't know, because it's a ripple effect. L'chaim, guys. All right.